podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show with accomplished chess players, authors, personalities, and adult improvers where they discuss their lives, their careers, and share tips about how to improve at chess. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. So without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have a guest I have long wanted to speak with that we finally found the time to reach out to, and fortunately, he is up for an interview. He is a senior lecturer on statistics at Harvard University with a PhD in statistics, also from Harvard. He's one of the world's leading experts on chess ratings and has been the chairman of the U.S. Chess Ratings Committee since 1992. He is the inventor of the Glico and Glico 2 rating systems, versions of which are used on Lee Chess and Chess.com, both, amongst many other gaming sites. He's also a USCF master, so he knows his subject well, and we'll get a bit into his chess towards the end. And he's written and co-written several papers on ratings, which I have been reading and, you know, understanding 80% of. So I'm excited to, we've got a lot of great listener questions related to ratings, and I'm excited to welcome our guest to the program, Dr. Mark Glickman. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for inviting me on your podcast. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm super excited. And thanks for all your contributions to chess over the years. I'm sure it can be relatively thankless working on these U.S. chess committees. And obviously, us chess players love our ratings. So just wanted to thank you for that.
Oh, yeah. No, my pleasure. Well, I'm sure half your listeners are going to be disappointed because the ratings at any point are going to go down. I'm happy. I'm glad I got involved. You mentioned I was chair since 1992. I actually got involved in becoming on the ratings committee in 1986 while I was in college. So it's been a long run.
Wow. Early start. And were you already interested in stats like consciously at that point?
Both consciously and unconsciously. So yeah, no, in 1986 was the year I graduated from college, and I was a statistics major at Princeton. In fact, I was the last person ever to major in statistics in Princeton, because that turned out to be the year that the department folded. Hopefully no connection to me.
Right.
I was actually writing a senior thesis on essentially a very focused topic having to do with ratings, essentially alternative ways to determine provisional ratings. So that's actually something that I worked on pretty intensely at Princeton. And like, that was a time where I was, I ended up joining the ratings committee.
Okay. Yeah. And actually it came up on a recent episode. So even listeners newer to chess might know provisional ratings, of course, are when you play your first tournament, they give you a rating that hasn't stabilized yet. Mm-hmm. And traditionally what's done is you add 400 points to an opponent's rating if you beat them, subtract 400 if you lose, and use the opponent's rating if you draw, and then just take the average until you've played something like 25 games. So, Mark, I'm curious what your alternative ideas were.
Well, that whole procedure is actually very ad hoc, and I had a sense of that even back when I was in college. So, I mean, basically, what I ended up doing is something that is probably fairly, fairly natural. And I think, a lot of people who do statistical work would, do what I'm about to describe, without even blinking an eye. Essentially the idea is that you can write out a probability of the outcome of a game given the player's ratings, or at least you can, come up with reasonable formulas that if you and I have ratings that can be supplied, there are probabilities that you can write out as formulas that depend on the ratings of the players. And there's a procedure in statistics, which is what's called maximum likelihood estimation. And the basic strategy there is that if you basically take a data set and you write out a formula that is the formula for the probability of observing the data that you saw, based on, in this context, based on, say, unknown ratings, then what you try to do is you try to figure out what must those ratings be in order to make that probability of what you saw as most likely as possible. So the basic strategy is that you have this formula that for the game outcomes that you saw. You don't know what the ratings are, but what you're trying to do is you're trying to maximize the value of the probability of what you see, of what you ended up seeing, as a function of these unknown ratings. And then determining what those unknown ratings are is this this approach called maximum likelihood. Most of the thesis kind of evolved around that idea of determining first ratings for players. And it was a little more than that, but that was the basic, the basic idea underlying, what I worked on back then.
And how was, do you remember how your paper was received? Did you get an A?
I graduated, summa cum laude. That's what it is. Yeah. So I think I got highest honors in graduating from Princeton based on my thesis. So I guess it was pretty well received.
Excellent.
They made me defend it. I mean, something that they don't do very often these days. When you write a senior thesis in college, you basically just write the paper, hand it in, and then you get some feedback and something that is like a grade. But in my case, and I guess what they were doing back then is that in addition to just having this written work, you had to get up in front of the entire faculty and prepare a presentation. And that almost cured me of not going into academics. because that didn't go so well. I mean, I think I was describing things accurately, but I was pretty scared to death in lecturing in front of a whole bunch of people that I've never, they were clearly experts in statistics, and who am I, the senior who thought about this project for about a year. I don't know. It was very uncomfortable, and I didn't think it went well. And I was ready to kind of turn it in at that point, and then just instead of going into academics, I'd go into industry. But I ended up deciding the academic route.
And now you get to terrorize the students.
Exactly. Well, we don't terrorize them by having them defend their thesis. So
okay,
it's a little we're a little nicer these days.
Glad to hear it. And Mark, I did read the papers that are linked to on your website, which of course I'll share in the show notes, about ratings. And as I said, understood most of them. And in the first paper that you linked to, you sort of gave a bit of historical context about how Arpad Illo, who of course is most commonly credited with inventing the rating system, Hungarian American physics professor, didn't actually invent it. Could you provide just a bit more context to listeners who have not yet had the opportunity to read your work?
Well, what's kind of interesting is that there are sort of these parallel worlds that went on. I mean, so Illo, Illo was essentially developing an improvement to an existing system that was being used by U.S. Chess Federation, which I believe was the Harkness system. And I think what happened is that, this is now back in the 1950s. And in the Harkness system, the formulas were super simple. And, there were these winning expectancies expected game outcomes that could be derived from the ratings that were produced by the Harkness system. And they just they were completely out of whack. They just didn't make any sense. It was very easy to game the Harkness system. And, Illo, I guess, at the time had some interest in ratings. And he basically developed a system where the main innovation, I guess, in Illo's system was that while the Harkness system was using very simple, I'll describe them as linear formulas, what Illo stumbled on was essentially using some of these ideas in certain kinds of probability models that were nonlinear. And the basic idea is that in using these nonlinear systems, he recognized that if you have a rating difference between between two players that was a rating difference of 300 points, the difference in the outcome, if you then expanded the rating difference to say 500 points is not going to be all that much. So the actual gain in increasing 200 rating points when you're already 300 points higher than your opponent is not really changing the winning expectancy very much. On the other hand, if you were already, if you compared a situation where you're evenly matched with your opponent, you had the same rating, and then you increased the rating by 200 points, that would result in an enormous difference in a winning expectancy. So it actually matters what the rating difference already is when you're comparing increases in ratings to what the impact is on the expected outcome of a game. And that comes in the nonlinearity of the formulas. And that's one of the main things that, ELO recognized. Now, the reason that I said that they're kind of like these parallel worlds is that around the same time, maybe a little bit earlier, there are scholars, researchers in statistics. The main person was this guy named Ralph Bradley, and he was working on essentially the theory of these probabilities of game outcome models, much more from a statistical standpoint. And he developed something in collaboration with collaborator of his, which eventually became known as what's called the Bradley-Terry model. And the Bradley-Terry model is essentially the winning expectancy formula that ELO used. And that serves as the basis for a lot of work in statistics that has come since then, including a lot of my own work. But it's interesting to see that the Bradley-Terry model in statistics, which essentially is the same underlying set of formulas as the ELO model, came about a little bit before ELO. And, there's always been at least speculation among people that are kind of in the intersection of chess and statistics, whether ELO actually was aware of the work that Bradley and Terry were doing at that time. But it's interesting how they're, strands of work that were going on that kind of led to, what's in use today, essentially.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, certainly across history, there's a lot of examples of things being sort of invented parallel, even outside of statistics. But so what's the prevailing theory amongst you, as you say, the intersection of chess rating and statistics aficionados? Do people think that ELO was aware of this other system?
I don't know if it's ever been really resolved. I mean, there are a lot of hints that he must have known it just because it seemed a little too coincidental. That, he came up with, more or less the same basic formula as what was being used. On the other hand, I mean, I guess I should mention that there was this, this work that was done about 30 years before then, by this, this mathematician, Zermelo, who, kind of in a very, very isolated context actually did develop the same formula. And I think at the time, people were just not generally aware of Zermelo's work. I mean, Zermelo is much better known for all kinds of crazy things in math. He was a huge contributor to set theory and various other things. Zermelo was just really an amazing mathematician. But I guess he must have been a chess player because he ended up doing this this little bit of work about how do you estimate player strengths in resulting from an incomplete round robin tournament, and it has some really brilliant ideas that were way ahead of his time, but that paper was forgotten for pretty close to 30 years until people started thinking about these problems again in the 1950s. And, then that paper got rediscovered and there was some connections there. So I guess that, to make a long story short, it's entirely possible that ELO was not aware of the work, the sort of the concurrent work by Bradley and Terry, but he was aware of Zermelo's work, which predated him by about 30 years. But no one knows for sure.
Okay. Yeah. And obviously it's, you know, stood the test of time, whether it's perfect or not. Elo is the main prediction engine for 538's sports models. And yeah, apparently it's even been used on Tinder, at least internally, to rank people in the dating pool. Although I think they say they don't do it anymore.
So they hired me about 12 years ago. I don't think I'm giving anything away. I guess I'm not allowed to say precisely what I did, but they did approach me about how to use, the essentially chess ratings to do matchmaking on Tinder. So actually a graduate student of mine and I ended up doing some work for them. In the end, what we actually gave them was something that, you know, we felt like they wanted to just basically superimpose ELO system, or, you know, basically these kinds of systems that are used for rating chess players, and just kind of like superimpose it onto what they're doing. And we were making the point that, there's actually something a little bit more principled you can do, because, the basic idea is that when somebody is like, you know, swiping left, swiping right, it's the same person. It's not a whole bunch of different people. And you can actually take advantage of that in a statistical model. So we actually gave them something a little different. And then that pretty much ended our relationship. maybe they were much more interested in just like having, something like an ELO system, just kind of apply directly. But we thought there's something you can do a little bit better.
Huh. Yeah. Fascinating stuff. And Mark, in your 1995 paper, A Comprehensive Guide to Chess Ratings, you wrote, mm-hmm. The introduction of the chess rating system has probably done more to increase the popularity of tournament chess than any other single factor. Which I found striking, and, you know, maybe Queen's Gambit has changed that now.
Yeah, I know. I think generally, as a marketing tool, ratings have a very important role to play, I think, in competitive chess. I don't think I was necessarily the first person to say that. I don't remember where I'd read, similar opinions about ratings really doing more to influence the participation in competitive chess really than more than any other factor. I mean, frankly, over the years, there've been, like one or two events that have just like really inspired people. And I think they mostly have to do with, the coming along of like, truly exceptional players. I mean, the most obvious example in my mind is when, Fischer came into prominence in the late 60s, early 70s. And, he clearly got people inspired in chess. But and to some extent, I'd say Kasparov had a very similar effect. But, but kind of as like sort of a long term idea, I think just building ratings into competitive chess, somehow makes competitive chess a little bit more official. It's not just people playing games and winning prizes. There's something a little bit more, at stake, and, something a little bit more official about, being involved in an organization that, not only governs tournament chess, but also, provides you estimates of how strong you are, using some, technology. So I don't know. I stand by that as probably, one of the biggest factors that, not only encourages people to play, but kind of keeps them involved in playing in tournaments.
Yeah. And you raise an important point in one of your papers that I hope to explore more later as we sort of talk about, I definitely want to talk about sort of the current rating landscape and the unique circumstances of people coming back from COVID. But you mentioned even in your writing long before this, that the rating scale as currently constructed can only be judged relative to the pool of players, not like objective strength.
Yeah, it's very hard. I know that there's some work in statistics that particularly in sports analytics that have like tried to bridge abilities strengths of athletes over time. And try to, with the intention of trying to make the comparison across eras. It's very hard to do because, you know, especially in a game like chess, because like chess knowledge is just increasing over time anyway. And so if you have a pool of players, say like in the 1950s, that, you know what they know about chess. And then since then, you know, we've just learned so much more about, you know, what constitutes good chess play, you know, then there's like this shared knowledge that's been gained over time. And there's really no way that, you know, we can directly measure, you know, what's the impact of this increase in shared knowledge, because there's no way to take somebody, you know, currently and have them play against somebody in 1950 to see what's the comparison of what people know. And so that's why I make, you know, that's why I make a point. I think it's a fairly self-evident point that, you know, you can only judge how strong people are relative to who else is around at the time, because those are the potential competitors that you would be having as opponents. You can't really judge how good you are compared to somebody from, you know, say 50, 70, 100 years ago, because, you know, the state of knowledge about chess is changing over time.
Right. Although we have a listener question related to Dr. Kenneth Regan, who of course is one of the leading experts on cheat detection and also statistics professor and international master who's been on the show. And Ken has written a paper about the concept of an intrinsic rating, where he basically does use engines to compare, you know, the best move to like compare someone's play to the best move. So I'll just read Tyron Price's question and then maybe you could address this. But I think you also mentioned to me that it might be a question best addressed to Ken Regan, who I hope to interview again someday. Mm-hmm. So anyway, Tyron's question is, are you familiar with Ken Regan's work on intrinsic rating? If so, what do you think of it? And is there a simple way for a player to estimate their intrinsic rating? He says he tried to follow the math and it's way over his head.
Yeah, I know of it, but I actually haven't looked at any of the details. I've only, you know, I'm only aware of it in passing because it's very much connected to Ken's work. I can certainly comment on the general principle, which is that using a chess engine to analyze the quality of moves, I think does have some promise, and that is a way in some ways to be able to, you know, bridge the gap to some extent. I mean, now the other factor in all this is that, you know, we're basically assuming that we're using a chess engine that has the state of knowledge right now, and it's making a very strong assumption that what we're considering a chess engine to be how it's actually analyzing how good moves are is relative to the state of knowledge right now. So if you believe that chess engines basically are invincible and they are finding the absolute best moves, and you know, I think they're doing something reasonably close to that at this point, you know, certainly with enough time, but you know, there are enough nuances where you could sort of argue that the strength that's attached to analyzing individual moves, you know, there's enough little bits of variation, I think, in the choice of moves, in how you know, say Stockfish might, you know, the program Stockfish might analyze games, that you can't necessarily, I think believe that it's always finding the optimal way forward. And the way that applies to this argument about being able to measure chess strength going back many years is that, you know, maybe like kind of to first order, it might be doing a reasonable job, but I think there's enough nuances in chess style that, you know, what it might consider to be optimal moves is not necessarily optimal by like a true objective standard.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, if you just compare Alpha Zero and Stockfish, like mm-hmm. the top move is going to differ fairly frequently.
Exactly. The other related issue, and I'll mention this quickly, is that, you know, there's also this presumption that the, you know, just simply being able to detect or evaluate move by move is essentially solving the problem of being able to rate players. And I think that that's actually the harder problem. And that's actually something that I've been, that's on my shelf of things that I really want to work on. In other words, I very much am planning as like one of my next major projects to be able to come up with a really good rating system that's that depends on move evaluations.
Oh, great.
Because I think that is really where the future is in being able to understand, playing strength.
Yeah. And of course, for OTB chess, you know, there might be some logistics issues in terms of making sure you get all the games and stuff like that. But for online chess, it's easy to imagine a world where it's automated.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And my understanding, and I can't say, with 100% certainty, but my understanding is that the algorithms to actually measure chess strength and relate them to like even an ELO scale is not well developed yet. I think the jury is out on the best way to do that. And it's a complicated problem because it's not just simply a matter of, evaluating each individual move, comparing it to, the arguably best move and looking at that difference. And then average, which is what's often called the centipawn loss. And then averaging that difference between what a player moved and what's considered to be the optimal move and averaging that across all the moves that they've played in a game. You can't do that as the right strategy because, for example, in various parts of the game, particularly, say in closed positions where the moves are just, each individual move itself is not going to be very impactful. So you'll have these like long strings of moves in a game where, there's really no real change in the centipawn loss. And yet it's going to have a very significant impact if you just include each individual move in that average. So there needs to be some curating of like which moves are more relevant than others. And I think the argument actually is a little more nuanced than that, but that's kind of the basic problem of just simply averaging over every single move in a game.
Right. And conversely, if you have like a 5-point advantage and you play a move that simplifies but retains a 3-point advantage, it might be the best move from a human perspective, but the engine might dock you if it's not told not to. So
exactly. Yeah. Right. And so all those kinds of factors need to be taken into account. And I have some thoughts about how to have a kind of a nice overarching model for how this can be done in an appropriate way. But like, I need data.
Yeah. That would be amazing. So
this is going to be a fun project. I'm very much looking forward to this.
Great. And we've got a lot of topics to hit, a lot of listener questions and stuff, Mark, but what's your sort of big picture view of like, do you feel like the FIDE and the US chess rating systems are working generally?
They're challenging. I have a particular bias, which is that that none of these rating systems outside of the ones that I've developed, but the ones that are in use in chess for say like USCF and FIDE, which are purely ELO based, they don't account for the uncertainty in a rating. In other words, when you get, let's say you've played a bunch of tournaments, you've gotten to the point in US chess where you've gotten an established rating, and then you haven't played for a while after that. And you come back to playing in a tournament, and the way US chess works is that, once rated, always rated. Your last rating will be the current rating that you'll be using in your next tournament. And not only that, the formulas going forward based on the results of having returned to play are going to be the same as what they were when you were playing actively. Now, just from a very logical standpoint, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense because if, say, a couple years goes by and you haven't played in competitive chess, we really don't have a very good handle on how strong you are at this point. I mean, you could have, for all we know, you could have, been playing quite a lot and then improving, in which case you're actually much better than your rating seems to convey. Or for that matter, you just could have dropped chess entirely and stopped playing altogether, and then maybe just woke up one morning and decided that you wanted to start playing again. But in that case, your ability is probably much worse than your reported rating. So the issue is that, just even from the passage of time, your rating that's kept on record, is almost much more like a provisional rating. It's not really, a measure of your ability that you can really trust. And so the kinds of rating systems that I've developed really are designed to tackle that particular issue. It's being able to quantify how reliable a rating actually is. So both ELO and, the ELO rating in particular is a rating system that doesn't have any kind of rating uncertainty quantification attached to it. And I think that's creates all kinds of problems. I could just like rattle off a list of problems that's a consequence of not incorporating uncertainty. One just very quickly is that I think for the longest time people have been attached to the idea, and they thought this was actually a great feature of the ELO system, that when your rating goes up by a certain amount, your opponent's rating goes down by the same amount. And so, the rating points are essentially conserved in a rating pool by having a system that way. But if you think about it a little bit, that's just, it's a really absurd idea to have a system require that, your rating, that rating points are conserved as a result of a game. And, the simplest kind of example of why that would be a problem is that, if I'm somebody who, has a very unreliable rating and I can measure that it's unreliable, and you're somebody who, say plays chess all the time, and so your rating is very stable and very believable and reliable, then, suppose that I defeat you in a game. Well, if I defeat you in a game, it probably isn't really saying very much about how strong you are, because for one thing, we don't really know how good I am at this point, because I have a very unreliable rating. And so the fact that I defeated you doesn't really say anything much about how strong you are. So your rating shouldn't change very much as a result of our game. Meanwhile, the fact that I defeated you being a very reliably rated player, should actually have an enormous impact on my rating. Like, my rating should go up a lot, relative to yours going down, because we've learned something really informative about how strong I am. So I would say that that's a very clear example where the rating exchange would not be even. Like, my rating should go up a lot and yours should go down barely any amount, if at all. And I think that's a good example of where, the ELO system and FIDE in particular kind of have some challenges. I mean, they do some things that address that issue, but they're not all that principled, I think.
Yeah, and of course, these issues are exacerbated here in the online age, where everyone, the opportunities to improve away from the tournament hall are greater than ever.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you mentioned that you've devised a system that you feel like is more responsive to sort of recent data and can fluctuate more if someone's out of practice. And of course, that's sort of the foundation of your Glico system that LeeChess and Chess.com use. And we have a question from an anonymous cognitive scientist and friend of the podcast. Who invented the name Glico system?
I think the person who asked the question actually invented the name. You're referring, of course, to Chris Chabris, a good friend of mine. He was my informal agent at the time. If I recall at the time the origin of all of this was that I was in, when I developed this system. So I developed the system around 1994, 1995, and somehow I don't remember the exact details of this aspect of it. But I was playing on FICS, the Free Internet Chess Server, and I somehow got into a discussion with the admins on this, on that system. And I might have just like mentioned to them that, oh, I've come up with this new rating algorithm that, one of the features of the algorithm is that it would actually quantify what players' uncertainty is and their ratings, and that players, when they play a lot, then their rating changes wouldn't be as high in magnitude over time. And then if players were, not playing for a while, then those rating changes would increase. And I think they liked the idea, and then they ended up implementing it. And that's kind of how the Glico system kind of caught on. Meanwhile, Chris was a good friend, and, I was telling him all about the rating system. And, I think at the time I was thinking, maybe I should call the system the GLO system. Having it be a direct connection to ELO. And eventually Chris convinced me that it would be better to call it Glico, to have a more overt connection to my name. So I've trusted his judgment about these things, and I still trust him now. And so I ended up, going with Glico, and so there it is. And I have to say that it's I've had some interesting experiences. I'll mention this. I went to this conference a couple of years ago in Rio de Janeiro. It was a statistics conference. And the way the conference was set up is that, like, we were all in this hotel, and then in order to get to the conference center, we had to take a bus to get there. And so I was kind of standing around waiting for the bus, and there was, a bunch of other statisticians there. So you can imagine what a good time that was. And so I was talking to this one guy, and I discovered he's actually a very famous statistician. I didn't recognize him by face, but, I was talking to him, he asks me, he asked me, my name. I mentioned I'm Mark Lichtman, and his eyes bug out, and he said, "You're the Glico guy. You're famous." So that was hearing that from somebody who, was a huge name in the statistics world, was actually, quite rewarding in a way. So
yeah, of course.
I think of Chris when those sorts of things happen.
Yeah, and it is a good name. So so shout out to Christopher Chabri, as always.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah. So we've got to take a break and hear from our sponsors, Mark, and then we're going to dive into some listener questions.
Sounds great.
Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by aimchess.com. AimChess, of course, collects your games from the major chess sites and then gives you an actionable study plan. So it's a great resource for players and coaches alike. It tells you how you compare to your rating peers in openings, end games, time management, all that stuff. It told me I was behind on the clock in 87% of my recent blitz games. I think I might need to work on that. And thanks to AimChess for pointing that out. But it's a great product. Go to AimChess and check it out. And if you decide to try out a subscription, use the code PERPETUAL30 to save 30%. As always, the info you need is also in the show notes. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by our longtime sponsors, our original sponsors, Chessable.com. Chessable, of course, is known for its proprietary move trainer technology, which utilizes spaced repetition to help you remember openings, tactical patterns, whatever it is that you're working on. They have a huge library of courses, including the free, short, and sweet versions of various openings. Speaking of openings, they just dropped Lifetime Repertoires, The London System by Grandmaster Lequang Liam. Love or hate The London, you got to know what to do against it, so be sure to take a look for that. And don't forget to sub to the How To Chess podcast hosted by yours truly. We just had Peter Sfidler on, other big guests in the works. So all the links you need are in the show description. Let's get back to talking chess. And we are back, and we've got a bunch of questions to bang out, so let's just dive right in. Of course, supporters of Perpetual Chess are able to find out the guests, and I was happy to get some great questions for Dr. Glickman. So question number one, I think, sort of sets the stage. It's from Ali Campbell, and Ali asks, he says, "I had a question about ratings for Dr. Glickman. If someone's rating increases from 1,000 to 2,000 over 10 years, one explanation would be that their playing strength increased by 100 points each year. but another is that their strength was always 2,000 and it just took 10 years for their rating to catch up. How can you tell which of these possibilities is true? Are GMs born at 2,500 strength and their improvement is illusory, or do they actually get stronger over the course of their life?
Well, all right. So let me answer the question this way. If this player was truly, say, 2,500 strength, and somehow by some quirk of the rating system, their initial rating was somehow assigned to be 1,000 or 1,200, you know, some low rating, then it would be very hard from the rating system to distinguish the two kinds of situations that Ali is talking about. Because, in either case, the player is going to be improving over time, or the rating is going to be changing over time and increasing in this, this approach of it going up about 100 points a year, say. So there's no way to tell. The safeguard in the rating system really is that it should, assuming that, for example, that the player, didn't, throw his games on the first time that they've played. And I know that players sometimes do that. But assuming that this player was truly 2,500 strength when they first started, and then they had, a rating that was calculated for them based on their initial performance, there's no way in the world that their rating would have started out at 1,200. I can certainly say with some amount of assuredness that that a player of 2,500 strength, unless they're purposely losing games to get a low first rating, would not end up being in a situation where their first rating was like 1,000 and that they would have to catch up.
Yeah, I guess there could be less extreme examples, but other than that, yeah. Yeah, and of course, I guess the whole scene setting thing is, it's like deliberately establishing a lower rating. I guess there's greater risk than ever now because of online play. It used to be no one would show up as a, even a 2,200-2,300, no one shows up fully formed. But these days I've interviewed people who are at or close to that strength who've, barely set foot in a tournament hall. So,
some of the work that was, that's been done for US chess for the rating system has been to suggest, mechanisms to identify these kinds of behaviors. And what we've always been suggesting is to construct, some kind of audit system that would be more based on things like essentially a performance rating calculation. So, like the simplest thing that could be implemented for, U.S. Chess Federation would be something like, look at players' performance ratings across the tournaments that they're playing and see what their performance rating, how their performance ratings, how they differ from, their performances in, money events versus say like, weekend quads or something. If there's some evidence that players are playing, substantially worse, there's a way to quantify like what's kind of worse, but like within, sort of normal variation. And then there's like worse where you're, losing the players that are much, much lower rated than you. If you can find examples of patterns where, players are performing exceedingly well at tournaments where there's, serious money prizes, and events where there's essentially no money prizes or very low entry fees, and players are just performing terribly, then you can identify, instances of fraudulent behavior, just purely from, from game outcomes. I'm sure Ken Regan would have something to say about that from the standpoint of actually looking at the moves, but you could even more coarsely evaluate it just based on performances with the players' ratings involved.
That's a good point and probably will be needed.
It's a little disappointing that at least, I've worked with US Chess for, forever. I don't know if they've actually implemented something like that. I think they have some very kind of crude after the fact version, but it seems like it's about time to automate this process and just have it be kind of like running, you know, kind of running in perpetuity. But I'm pretty sure that's not happening. But it would be nice if it were.
Yeah. Yeah. I know they've got a lot on their plate, but yeah, sure. Sooner. I mean, Gorchberg or someone like that could take it on as well. Big tournament organizer here in the US.
Right. Cause it exactly benefit, you know, that kind of a system would exactly benefit. But I think even with Gorchberg and you know, Continental Chess, they might even have their own, you know, internal system where they track players that are working, you know, within that are playing in Continental Chess events. And I think they might even just sort of do some of the work themselves, but it needs to be, you know, upscaled to, you know, national organizations.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. And the next question is from Mark Wilkins. And Mark asks, he says, the last 25 years, I've seen extremely quick progress in the development of statistical rating system, particularly due to the needs of real-time matchmaking for video games. What do you think the best opportunities are for over-the-board chess world to learn from these innovations? And what's your sense of how receptive the key players like FIDE, USCF, and other federations are to these changes?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that, you know, I've, you know, my involvement in U.S. chess is, you know, it's been around since, you know, the 80s and 90s. And, you know, along the way, I've been suggesting all kinds of changes to the rating system that are, you know, fairly technical. And these are the sorts of things that, you know, probably players wouldn't be able to, you know, to perform the calculations on their own, although, you know, they can certainly apply, you know, approximations to those calculations. But I've been struck really over the years how little appetite, you know, the boards of, you know, the executive boards of U.S. chess have been in particular for, you know, making these more technical changes. And I at one level, I understand their attitude because, you know, their feeling is that, you know, players derive certain satisfaction at being able to, you know, recompute their own ratings. And that's, you know, pretty much been, you know, true for as long as I've been involved. But on the other hand, that you're not getting a lot of accuracy with, you know, with these rating systems that, you know, are not, you know, as you know, technically principled as they could be. So my overall feeling is that USCF and FIDE, which is FIDE systems these days even simpler than USCF. I mean, these systems could really benefit a lot from having, you know, using some of the kinds of systems that are being used online. I mean, just one example is there is, you know, for a lot of the Microsoft online gaming, there's this rating system called TrueSkill, which actually turns out to be like very closely related to my Glico system, but also applies to, you know, multiple competitors, not just head-to-head games. But, you know, these kinds of systems tend to, you know, use pretty rigorous methods that go beyond, you know, what Elo and Bradley and Terry worked on. And they're, you know, much, you know, they're much more applicable and more reliable than, you know, what we're seeing that's being implemented for over-the-board chess. So I think there's a lot to learn. And I really wish that some of these organizations would, you know, realize that, you know, we're in a day now where it doesn't matter anymore for players to be able to compute their own ratings on a piece of paper. That's just not really where we are these days. And so it shouldn't be really holding back, you know, developing a rating system that can be implemented for use in USCF or FIDE. That's like, you know, as technically sophisticated as it needs to be in order to get accurate ratings for players.
So yeah. Hearing you talk about it takes me back to having like a handheld table where, like, after you play someone, you can check, okay, they're 300 points higher rated than me and I won. So that means, you know, I gained 24 points or whatever it
exactly.
is.
Exactly.
Like, eagerly check the table. Yeah. You don't really need to do that anymore. So,
no. And even with just, I mean, I guess, you know, the USCF administrators probably thought that when we moved over from that tabular output into just a formula, with the winning expectancy having an exponential in that formula. They thought that that was the limit, and you know, anything more complicated than that would be problematic. And of course, like, you know, now we're, you know, we're living in a world where, you know, iterative computing is like pretty much necessary to do anything serious. And so that's kind of where we are. And yeah, hopefully I'm sure that, you know, I mean, given how much online chess and a lot of these online organizations are popping up and drawing people away from over the board chess, hopefully, you know, entities like USCF and FIDE are going to wise up and, you know, be a little more serious about the kinds of rating systems that should be implemented.
Yeah. And I, in looking through the listener questions, I see that Alex Friedman had asked a question about the feasibility of adopting a Glico-like system. I think we've pretty much covered that. And Michael Spisner had asked about an objective system based on average centipawn loss, which I think
I would love that. I mean, again, it's not going to be quite as simple as just simply averaging the centipawn loss across games. It's much more involved than that. But I think the core idea of having a strong chess engine evaluate moves is has a lot of promise. Because you wouldn't need that many games to get an accurate rating, presumably.
Right. Yeah. More inputs. Yeah. That makes sense. Cool. And so you mentioned you've been a little disappointed with USCF not being sort of super responsive. Have you had any interactions with FIDE or other federations about potential changes?
Not directly. I mean, I've been kind of aware of what's been going on, and I've been in conversations where I think they were thinking about Glico. And then I guess somehow it didn't get to the point where they were, you know, serious enough that they wanted to, go with it. But I think for reasons I haven't been involved in these discussions, so I don't know exactly, what the rationale is, but I think they decided pretty much to kind of stick with their current system and make tweaks as needed. You know, the customer base for FIDE is a large group of chess players that, you know, are not necessarily looking to necessarily have very sophisticated rating algorithms. So, I mean, from that lens, it's you know, it's understandable what's going on. But at some point, you know, all of these different tweaks that are being made to the rating system are just not going to hold it together anymore and probably would need to reboot it. And then, you know, at that point, maybe they'll start looking for, you know, people who have thought about these kind of problems in a much more sophisticated way, especially the people that have been working with online systems. And then, you know, they'll get a more reliable type of rating system.
That would be welcome. So I've just got a few more topics to hit, Mark, sure. But first sure, I want to take one more break and hear from our sponsors. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by Chess.com, up-and-coming chess site named to watch in the space. Jokes aside, of course, Chess.com has entertaining Twitch streamers and Puzzle Rush is always fun, even if I'm bad at it. But it also has great educational materials. I'm a big fan of the drills to help you convert material advantage against those super strong bots. Obviously, the game reports after every game are indispensable. Even when they're telling you that you played badly, you gotta do it and learn from it. And of course, I've advocated in the past for the vision trainer, especially if you're trying to learn the coordinates so that you can read the chess books that we talk about, or if you just want to get faster with it, it's a great way to learn. So I think you know what URL to go to. Just be sure to take advantage of all the tools that chess.com has to offer. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by chessmood.com. Chessmood is a subscription-based instructional website founded by Grandmaster Avtech Gregorian, who you can hear on episode 192 of Perpetual Chess. Founded by Avtech and his team of Grandmasters, there's a huge library of opening, middle game, and end game videos. There's special events like webinars, streams, one-on-one blitz games. Every Chess Mood member gets a consultation call with one of the Grandmaster coaches. And also be sure to check out Chess Mood's free content. Avtech has a great blog. They also have a YouTube channel where they're posting videos from Grandmasters daily. So links you need are in the show description, but be sure to check out chessmood.com. And we are back. So, Mark, one other sort of big topic that I, of course, wanted to discuss is the idea of rating deflation, which has come up sort of anecdotally. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been my experience having played tournament chess for some 30 years that I certainly feel like, you know, a 2100 today is stronger than one of 30 years ago and so on down. And of course, it's an especially acute issue coming out of the pandemic. It's come up a lot on the podcast how obviously kids tend to improve faster and they can improve even without playing tournaments. So we're in a unique moment where kids are always known to be underrated. And now that can be exacerbated. But in reading your work, one thing that I hadn't come across was sort of the more broad deflationary tendency of the ELO system. So mm-hmm. to sort of set the stage, could you describe what you wrote about there?
Sure. I mean, the basic problem, again, with these rating systems is, the ones that don't really capture the uncertainty of a rating. And that's, to a large extent, what some of the problem is. With a system like the ELO system, your rating is always assumed to be reliable, or kind of equally reliable regardless of how old you are, how frequently you're playing, whether there's any evidence that you're improving over time. None of these factors is incorporated into the ELO system. So, if you're an adult player who's fairly stable, and versus a scholastic player who is just improving very quickly, even if the two players are starting out having the same rating, the rating changes are always going to be the same. So that if a player if a scholastic player is improving very, very quickly, the rating is going to lag behind. So that's essentially the mechanism by which ratings tend to deflate. It's not a necessary proposition that a rating system has to have deflation, but if you're not careful about how a rating system is, what the formulas are and how it's set up, which is, the ELO system is an example of, then you're going to have a problem where you have these players that are improving much more quickly than their ratings are tracking. And so you'll get to a point where, like, say, the scholastic player has a rating of, say, 1700, but in fact, they're like 2000 strength. And then what's going to happen is that they're going to be playing opponents that are, maybe rated appropriately, but the results of games between this underrated scholastic player and an appropriately rated opponent, those kinds of games are going to go in favor more often of the scholastic player relative to the rating. And that's going to essentially bring the ratings down. Because the scholastic player is going to basically have these, what would seem to be, unusually good results relative to his rating. And so their opponent's ratings are going to start going down. So the source of the deflation are players who are relatively stable, but they're playing against underrated opponents, like typically scholastic players.
Right. And you point out that a key point, I think, is that a lot of older players are leaving the pool. So they keep their rating. Maybe they would go down if they kept playing, but older established ratings leave the pool, and then young skilled players enter the pool mm-hmm. and need to get the rate, are going to get the rating points from somewhere.
Right. Well, again, that's a feature of ELO. It's not a feature of like all rating systems. So right. like, for example, a basic type of fix to this problem is, to recognize that when players are having their ratings move pretty rapidly upward, you could basically have a trigger in the system where when the players are just performing so much better than the rating, then the magnitude of the moves beyond that are going to be bigger. So for example, say you have a player who's 1500 rating, but it's pretty clear based on their performances that they're playing like an 1800, 1900 player because they're just defeating opponents left and right that are much higher rated than they are. And so in that kind of a situation, you would end up, a fix to this kind of problem that's very principled would be to say that once a player is identified as playing much better than their rating, what you could do is you can make their, their K factor in the rating formula, or just, whatever the magnitude of change is going to be as a result of the next tournament that they play in, is going to be much bigger. So when they play in their next tournament, it's not going to be like just adding a handful of rating points anymore when they have a good performance. You're going to end up adding a large amount of rating points. And so you'll be able to actually track their improvement much better. And that's, by the way, that's something that the Glico 2 system directly addresses. Because the Glico 2 rating system that I developed is specifically designed to track players that have sudden bursts in performance, and then it essentially makes their it makes their rating so uncertain that that it has the ability to actually move much more quickly beyond that. And so I think that's an important feature of a system to be able to build in if you know that there's deflation currently going on.
I'm sold, Mark. Where do I sign up for the Glico
system? Yeah, luckily, I tried to actually patent the Glico 2 system, and it was provisionally patented for a year, but then it wasn't marketed very well. And so I basically went in, of course, let it go into the public domain. So you can sign up anywhere you like and just like use the system, and it's all yours.
Excellent. And just a little more color from Ken Regan again. He wrote a blog post on July 30th where he looked at the intrinsic move quality, again, comparing to engines of the U.S. Championship and, the U.S. Women's Championship and the U.S. Junior Championship. So he was sort of able to begin to parse data about sort of the effect of the pandemic on different demographics. Mm. And definitely recommend listeners check out that post. And then he wrote a little comment at the end that looked at more data that's happened in subsequent months. But in conclusion, Ken wrote, "But I've certainly demonstrated the obvious that the current official ratings of almost all the keenest young players are very wrong." And of course, as we record this, 18-year-old Carissa Yip just like ran roughshod through the U.S. Women's Championship, which could be yet another example. And of course, you were out in front of this in your writing. You highlighted also the possibility of regional and countrywide issues with ratings, where if aren't traveling that much, different ratings can mean different things in different places. And again, anecdotally, but people always say that FIDE ratings of Indian players are preposterously underrated. So a lot of potential fixes. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to just say, that sort of thing happens, especially when, the pool of players that compete against each other are not mixing at all. And then again, it's the same issue that if that pool of players just seems to be getting better on average than some other pool of players over time, there's really no way for the rating system to pick that up. So the only way, except for, thanks to Ken and others, using a chess engine to evaluate actual moves and then somehow convert that into chess strength.
So lots of issues, and thank you for helping highlight them. If you're up for it, Mark, I'd like to just talk about your sort of life in chess a bit before we let you go. Are you okay on time?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Great. So you made it to USCF Master. So were you playing as a teen? What's your chess story?
Yeah, I mean, so I started playing. So I grew up in New Jersey. I mostly was playing in local events when I was growing up. So playing lots of quads, occasional weekend Swisses. And you know, so I most of my active years were in high school and college. And I was, you know, I got to the point of being expert, like in, you know, mid to high 2100s coming out of college. And then I for various reasons that I won't elaborate on, I decided to take a year gap between college and graduate school. And I decided that year to at least for a while to really you know, focus a lot on getting better at chess and playing more actively. And that was the year that I ended up becoming a master. And, you know, I really did, put a lot of effort into becoming better and did a lot of studying and, you know, as much as one could do in 1986 and 1987. And then, you know, I pretty much from that point onward, once I started graduate school, I wasn't playing nearly as actively. I played in, you know, occasional events in the Boston area, where, you know, cause I ended up coming here to go to grad school. Pretty much my activities sort of trailed off a little bit. I was playing in the U.S. Amateur Team East pretty regularly from year to year. And I pretty much kept that up until, the early 2000s. And then that was pretty much the last time I played in competitive chess. Other than playing online, but like I'm definitely, I want to at some point, start playing actively again. I think once life starts to, you know, sort of take it easy a little bit on me,
you gotta do the intrinsic rating paper first, Mark. No okay. Tournaments before then.
Perfect. Good idea.
So any particular books that you feel like made a big difference for your chess?
Books that made difference for me. I'm gonna turn around right now and look at my bookshelf to see what sort of jumped out at me. I don't know.
Okay, well, we can keep it going, and you can come back to it if you think of anything. I know it's been a while. And
yeah, I you know, so many endgame composition books were actually kind of fun. Like so. This Troitsky book is good. I have this German book of endgame compositions, and I don't remember. I think Herbstman might have written it. I forget. But yeah, some of those have been really a lot of fun.
Enjoyed
endgame compositions.
Cool. And do you play any online? Do you play any Blitz?
I haven't lately. I think the last time I played was a couple of years ago, and I think it got to the point where I was screaming enough at the computer that I felt it might be a little, and also my wrist, I think, was starting to get affected a little bit. I enjoy it, but like it's playing Blitz online. I make too many mistakes and I get down on myself a little bit too much.
Sounds all too familiar. Yeah.
And I'm sure most people have that experience, but I don't know how much screaming is involved with most, most players.
You're not the first, that's for sure.
Yeah. I'm not surprised.
Yeah. And what about following top level chess? Do you keep up with it at all?
A little bit, not really as much as I'd like to. I kind of keep on top of sort of the main things that are going on.
Okay. And I know that, the aforementioned Christopher Chabris has lots of stories from sort of, brushes with chess legends who came to Harvard when he was there. Do you have any similar or overlapping stories? Like Karpov and Kasparov, Simos, and meeting Anand through Patrick Wolf, and all these stories.
I guess I will mention this. So in the year between college and graduate school, I dated a top female chess player who was pretty well connected, and like that year. So part of the reason I got to be more serious about chess is I actually did get to meet a whole bunch of top players that year through her. And that was actually, that was kind of a neat thing because, you know, to the extent that I was like maybe a little bit, you know, like I read about all these players, I never really met them. You know, it started off as like a little bit of a starstruck experience, but then, you know, I got to know all these people and it actually was quite a lot of fun. So I don't know. That's been my big brush with fame, I suppose.
And I get the sense you don't want to reveal the player that you did.
Yeah, well, maybe it'd be better if I didn't. Yeah, I didn't go into it because I don't want to get any repercussions. I mean, it's all fine, but I don't want to start dragging in that person.
Are any of the encounters particularly memorable? The people that you met from these experiences?
Not really. I don't know. I mean, I suppose one of the more memorable experiences that I've had was actually involved Chris Chabri, because back in 1992, there was this Karpov simul that went on in France, where Karpov ended up playing teams of four players that were at different universities. And the way that the simul was done was that the four players could collude and decide on their moves together. And I guess as an example of like teleconferencing or video conferencing, back in 1992, they decided to bring in a team from MIT and Harvard. And so we basically put together these couple friends of mine at MIT, and I got together. And we were actually one of the teams that were asked to play against Karpov in this this video conference event. And so the way that Chris was involved, I think Chris was involved somehow in the logistics of running the event. But more particularly, he was the person who was making Karpov's moves for us. So like basically we were in a room and Chris was sitting on Karpov's side of the board. And then we were, colluding, trying to decide on our moves, and then would make the move on the board, and then Chris would make the move back. And I have to say, one of the memorable things about that, aside from getting destroyed pretty quickly by Karpov, was that there would be times where, we would all be sitting there waiting for Chris to move, and as it turned out, the move was already made, and we just didn't notice it. And Chris always like looked at us in a kind of a puzzled way about when we were going to actually like realize that it was our it was our turn. So that was a little embarrassing, but it was quite a lot of fun, and it was a fun experience playing against Karpov while he was in Paris and we were in Cambridge.
Wow, yeah, that's pretty cool. And just one more sort of question I wanted to hit on, Mark, is I saw that you founded a sports analytics laboratory. Mm-hmm. So I was curious if you can think of any sort of applications of big data, the data revolution that could be applied to chess that you're not seeing take place right now, aside from all our rating conversations.
Usually the question that ends up getting asked is actually the reverse. So it's interesting you ask. Huh. In other words, like what?
Yeah, because of engines, I guess.
Well, what can we learn about rating chess players that can be applied to sports? Because I have some contract work with the U.S. Olympic Committee where I'm actually helping them like rate athletes in different sports and to be able to estimate how good they are and how likely they are to win various events, even outside the Olympics. It's hard to think of the reverse direction, namely, applying ideas from sports to chess, because a lot of the work that goes on in sports analytics these days is using like, for example, player tracking data, like looking at the locations of players on a field and then seeing what their movements are like, especially in conjunction with other teammates. And then, being able to kind of like learn what sort of strategies work, what don't work. I guess the closest thing really to those kinds of tasks is really using chess engines to be able to evaluate individual positions and being able to assess ability and learn something about strategy. Mm-hmm. It's hard to think of examples that are just like really directly related, that could be applied that are being used in sports analytics, that can be used in chess. Because I know my experience is that it's been much more common to go the other direction. A lot of the stuff that I do in sports analytics actually is like taking ideas from what's been done in rating chess players and seeing, you know, what might apply to, you know, rating athletes and examining career trajectories over time.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that chess is not behind in that regard.
Yeah.
So I think we've covered all the topics I wanted, Mark. I mean, I do feel like you've helped highlight some serious problems in the rating system. I mean, you know, and honestly, it sounds like the Glico, your systems or similar systems could solve a lot of them. So, how do we make it happen? What do you think? Do we start a petition or what?
Oh, I don't know. If I had the answer, I suppose, the U.S. Chess Federation rating system, you know, for the last 20 years would have been something that looks a lot more like Glico. So I'm probably not the right person since I'm not, you know, I don't have the right marketing skills, but I don't know. I mean, I have to say there is a move right now, to try to get, rating, uncertainty attached to USCF ratings. So that's been something that, came up a few years ago. And you know, the executive board was actually interested in coming up with a measure of like rating reliability, because I think they started seeing the light, and then it's now a couple years later. I think there's still interest in that direction, but my understanding is that their level of interest is more as a way of just simply quantifying the uncertainty, whereas like something in Glico actually takes that measure and builds it into the rating updates, which mm-hmm. it doesn't sound like USCF is quite ready to do. So I don't know. I mean, like they're sort of inching forward, I suppose. I don't know what it's going to take to get there.
Yeah. And I agree with you about USCF, but FIDE changes would be welcome as well, to be clear. Mm. And I did think of one more thing. Sorry.
Sure.
Okay. I don't know how up you are on sort of the online rating systems, but lately it's becoming more of an issue to sort of translate ratings because chess.com ratings might have like a mild upward skew compared to FIDE and USCF, but then LeChess has incorporated a system, which I think was as the system was originally intended, where you keep 1500 as either, I think it's the mean or the median rating. Mm-hmm. Okay. And because of that, it pushes up the whole scale. And it just results into like all kinds of, I understand the reasons for each place doing it, yeah. But it causes confusion because you always have to specify and then try to translate. So do you think there's any hope of like a universal rating system that like incorporates online identity and live identity and makes things less confusing?
Yeah, I'm skeptical something like that would ever happen just because, you know, everybody is kind of working separately, but I can imagine that there might be, a service that might be able to figure out how to translate from one system to the next, because all that really is required is you just need to have a whole bunch of people and their current ratings on these different systems. And then you can develop a statistical, conversion process that will tell you how to translate a rating in one system to a rating in another. So, yeah, I think it's more optimistic that something like that will probably pop up at some point.
So we're headed for a Celsius and Fahrenheit world in chess.
Yeah, pretty much. And yeah, I think the conversion formula is going to be a little bit more complicated than between Fahrenheit and Celsius, partly because like different ranges of the rating systems
actually
have different
speeds.
Yeah, different speeds, exactly. Yeah, different speeds.
Yeah. And to be clear, such sites already do exist and they're gathering data quickly and doing a good job. It's just, it's a bit, I might have a unique job where it's uniquely frustrating because I'll say a rating since I grew up with the USCF and FIDE system, that's what I default to, but everyone's playing online now. So it just confuses things. But
yeah,
anyway, we've kept you long enough, Mark. I really appreciate your time. There's been some amazing insights, one of a kind. So really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
And if people want to keep up with your work or reach out to you, is there a way for them to do that?
Well, probably the first best stop would be just to go to my website, which is www.glico.net. And you know, my contact information is there and all kinds of other stuff that's kind of fun is up there too.
Excellent. Yeah. And I do encourage listeners to read Mark's papers. They hold up well, and I'll link to those and the aforementioned Ken Regan stuff as well. So thanks again, Mark. This has been awesome.
Well, thank you.
Thank you to everyone who listens to and supports the podcast. And most of all, thank you to my producer, Matthew Passy. Be sure to check us out on social media. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at BennyFishel1. We also have a Perpetual Chess Facebook group where we continue the conversation about each episode. I've even got the Instagram page locked and loaded, actually posting clips every week. So you can follow at Perpetual Chess to catch some clips there. I also want to thank our sponsors, of course, Chessable.com, the original sponsor of Perpetual Chess, Aim Chess, Chess Mood. Thanks. I'm proud to be affiliated with all of these sites. Also want to thank Blue Wire Podcast, with whom I partner. Big shout out to Blue Wire. Check them out for sports podcasts. But most of all, I want to thank the individuals who helped make Perpetual Chess go via PayPal or Patreon. And of course, they get to find out the guests, send in questions, hear occasional GM lectures on Zoom, and even get ad-free podcasts. So thank you all for supporting Perpetual Chess and keeping it going. So without further ado, I would like to give special thanks to the following people and entities. Chessable.com, David Lazarus of LazmanChess.com, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Abysmal Depths of Chess blog. Shout out to JB. Adapta Interactive Web Designs and Services, the Apprentice Twitch channel, Aniti Deer, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porteau, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, the Charlotte Chess Center, the Chess Central's Chess Blog, ChessMood.com, Chris Flanagan, Chris Lott, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel He, Danny Davidson, David Mitchell, I am Dimitri Schneider, Douglas Wilson, I am Eric Rosen, Farhan Thawar, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Glenn Downing, Greg Harfst, Greg Shahadi, Gregory Gulick, Hampus Axelson, James Kennedy, Jay Garrison, Jeff Martinson, Jeff Schaefer, Jeremy Nilsson, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John MacArthur, Kevin Forsyth, Kevin Gilmore, Kevin O'Callaghan, Kevin Pryor, King's Celt, King's Crusher YouTube channel, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, Matthew Feeney, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mr. Mike Shahadi, the famous Mr. Dodgy, the NerdNace Twitch channel, Peter McManus, GM Peter Prohaska, Peter Soddy, Philip Vlummens, the Playmore Chess Academy of the Hamden Chess Club, Ray Lillywhite, Reuven Fisher, Robert Hansen, Ross Crossland, Seattle Chess Club, Shane Unger, Stefan Kelty, Stephen Martinez, Sven Gearson, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryant of StrongChess.com, Todd Kennedy, The Vintage Patsers, which is a Chess.com improver group, and Wayne Beam. I would also like to give thanks to East Viega, Adam Fowler, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Al Hastings, Alan and Maggie Sue, Alex Pejas, Alexander Markovitz, Antonio Cancino, Antonio Leonfor, FM Andre Tarakov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Angus McLeod, Barry Hessian, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Bill Trammell, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brandon Halseed, Brian Chase, Brian Mullis, Bruce Scott, Brian Tillis of Palm Beach Chess, Cameron Davis, Ken Kabadayu, Ken Kabadayi, Chad Hilton, Chad Likens of Rose City Chess in Portland, Oregon, Chess for Charity in Jacksonville, Chess Patzer Spain, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Kiefer, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Chabrie, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, a.k.a. Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Costa Caros, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsburg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Best, Dave Saylor, David Blaskoczek, David Brown, David Goris, David Hamblin, David Cramley, David Peterson, Dennis Parrish, FM, Donnie Ariel, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ed Mead, Edwin Rodriguez, Ethan Smith, Evan Rosenberg, Ewan Richardson, Ian Mason, Felipe Melo Perilla, Fox Valley Chess Club, Francis Letart Lavoie, Frank Tortoris, MD, Frank Zananis, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Gautam Narula, Gene Stewart, George Foote, George Harris, Giovanni Russo, Gregory Higgins, Han Schut, Harish Srinivasan, Howard V. Han, Jacob Kovach, Jason Apollo, Jason Murray, Jacques Perry, James Aspinwall, James Benastia, James Muir, Jason Woolham, Jay Tuttle, Jaydeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jesse Damas, DeCumus, excuse me, Jesse McNulty, Jim Ratliff, Jim Sadler, Joe DeSano, Joe Valdez, Joel Thomas Ramos, John McAdams, John Tully, Juan Almaguer, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Bannister, Jonathan Slater, John Quist, John Tully, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, Justin Goodfeller, Jen Chahadi, Joe Rocky, John Thompson, Grandmaster Josh Friedel, I am Kare Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, I am Kostya Kovutsky of Chess Dojo, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Cook, Larry Ryforth, Macaulay Peterson, Maria Emelyanova, a.k.a. Photo Chess, Mark Chaves, Mark Fitzpatrick, Mark Miller, Mark Wilkins, Marco Bulatovic, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matt Ferrari, Matthew Allen Coughlin, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, Matthias Plock, the Mechanics Institute of San Francisco, Michael Ollard, Michael Hudson, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Goble, Nate Solon, Neil Bruce, Negmat Milijanov, Nicholas Isabel, Olaf Mueller-Michaels, Pablo Davila, Grandmaster Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Eckert, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Queenside Management Limited of Switzerland, Randall Montgomery, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hollenbach, Richard Tucker, Robert Callahan, Robert Turner, Robert Wall, Robert Wilson, Rory Coleman, Ryan Berg, Samson Teaches Chess, Satyajit Malugu, The Say Chess Publishing, Unstoppable Empire, Scott McKinnon, Scott Rose, Sean Krause, Sebastian Finsterwalder, Sergey McKagan, Seth Ruzica, Seth Will, Sean Tracy, Silver Knights in Richmond, Simon Schmidt, Stefan Roller, Stephen Miller, and Tom George, WGM, Tatyav Abrahamian, Terry King, Thomas Brown, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, FM, Timothy Wall, Tobiah Rex, Tom Edsel, Tommy Farron, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Victor Beauchamp, William Brock, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng of chess1000.com, and last but never least, Zhivko Stoyanov. So thanks for listening, everyone. We will catch you all next week.
Podcast Network.